Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. Today is Thursday, February the 12th, 2026. And, you know, I'm not where I'm still writing 25 or typing 25 for a date anymore. It still seems weird to be more than a quarter century into a new century. If you were born, when I was earlier, I bet, anyway, even for a lot of you guys, maybe 5-10 years younger than me, it's still kind of weird. If you're like, you know, I grew up in the 70s, the 80s, but if you grew up in the 80s and 90s even, for it to be 2026, you're like, something's wrong. There's nothing wrong. Tick tock, tick tock. The clock ticks for us all. You're either working on your liberty, independence, and self-sufficiency, or life is moving you backward, because life is not a static scale. It never is. You're going one direction or the other. That's how it works. With that in mind, what are we going to talk about today to help us free our minds and free our lives so that we can live that better life that we talk about all the time? We'll start off with Ron Paul and Dan McAdams from the Weekly Liberty Report highlight. This time we have a kind of an irony. It almost sounds like a Twilight Zone episode, and I agree with the take here. This is the age of an Orwellian America, where we have a president marketed as the peace president, and he's bombed 7 countries. That's in a year and a month. You count his first term, it's really 10. The peace president, 10 nations, bombs dropped. Jesse Markowitz will talk about what is the impact on energy cost on Bitcoin. I didn't listen to this one fully yet. I listened to the beginning. I know he's on the right track. I might or may not expand on this when I listen to it with you guys as we put the show together today. Ryan Steva will expand, like I like to expand. He's going to expand on a segment by Kerry Brown on urban foraging, which either last week or the week before. I think it was last week. And this is a really interesting thing, and I have like a thought on this one because I have a similar opportunity, but it's not the same opportunity. I'd have to handle it differently. And I wonder if that would be possible. And it's also going to talk a little bit about these areas that cities, counties, towns put in for people to use for recreation that are not well thought out, even when everything you need is actually already there. And you won't use it for some reason. It'll make sense when we get to it. Next up, we're going to hear from Andy McCann on cholesterol levels for those on carnivore and keto, and home cholesterol test kits. And this is stuff you've heard from Doc Barry well into the past if you've been around a while, but it always helps to hear it again, especially maybe from a different perspective. Nick Ferguson will talk about who should and should not consider raising meat rabbits. Everybody can do anything, but not anybody can do everything, right? Nicole Sauce will do another tag team with Kerry Brown. Kerry's popular today, even though he's not on the show directly. Any questions for Kerry Brown? But Nicole is following up on a segment he did last year, which isn't that long ago, honestly, but on making shag bark hickory syrup, because he talked all about it, but he didn't tell you how to actually make it. Well, she's going to tell you how to make it. And then John Pugliano has a grab bag of investing debt and tech investing questions. And I'm going to finish up with something very homestead practical. That's been the lane I've been in all week, and I kind of want to stay there. And that is how to crush biochar at a homestead level without getting all complex and making your own machine or buying some sort of expensive equipment and retrofitting it. Like, is there an easy way? And the answer is yes. There absolutely is. And I'm also going to talk about what we strive for versus what we need, and how a lot of the very good work being done by companies who want to sell you biochar may be leading you to believe what is perfect is what you need, when what you need is right in your own backyard. If you don't try for perfection and don't let perfect be the enemy, not just of the good, but the more than good enough. And we'll talk about all of that in just a bit. Before we do, I want to tell you about something. And we've got Nick Ferguson today talking to you about rabbits. And Nick is a hell of a rabbit expert. But what he's most known by this audience for, of course, is plants. Nick is the plant man. In fact, people have talked about a plant app like for your phone that would like identify and give you characteristics and things you can do and how to like all the stuff on every plant. You just take a picture and it knows it all. And they want to call it Pocket Nick. That tells you who this guy is, right? So Nick every year does a plant sale at rareplantstore.com, okay? That's the site, rareplantstore.com. You should go there, get on his distribution list and all. The thing is, this is not your typical, like, nursery plant website. If you go there this summer and try to order something, you won't be able to. If you go there in the fall and try to order something, unless something changes from the way he's been running things for years now, you won't be able to. The spring is the time for shipping bare root plants. And Nick does not have like 8,000 plant varieties. He has, you know, several dozen really good things that he has determined are the best things for people to get their food forests and home orchards and things like that started with. And he has a pack this year called the Fruit and Nut Pack. Three varieties of three different plants. It's three Chinese chestnut trees, three high bush blueberries, and three American elders. This is a great pack that he's put together. And it's $62. And there's other options and there's other packages too. And you can, you know, the more you buy, the better the deal. All of that goes on. But I want to just, on this one deal that I'm running for him today as a host on the blog, kind of put some numbers in this to give you an idea of how good of a deal that is. All I did was put in the plant varieties and look for any catalog where you would go to buy, you know, one, two, three items at a time, right? And what are they selling for? And I didn't even go to one catalog, whichever popped up and was like the first catalog I could find, to get some average pricing. Chinese chestnut trees sell generally for about $25 to $30. Call it $30, right? That's $90. Three of them. High bush blueberries. These are going to sell in the $15 to $20 range. And then you got elderberries, and they're going to sell somewhere between $12 and $15 a plant. Three of each. You're looking at about $135 if you were to buy this from, like, Gurney's or, you know, Raintree or anybody else. Willis Orchard, etc. That's really about $135 plus shipping, which, of course, you're going to have to pay Nick a little bit for shipping. That's if you find a single source, though, for all of them. If you have to go to two or three different places, you could be looking closer to like $160 to $200 because everybody's going to ding you for shipping. And there's just a certain amount to get things out the door with shipping costs. And like all costs, shipping's gone up, not just what they charge you, but what they pay. So all I'm saying is that this package for $60 is a damn good deal. And what you should do if you're like, I don't know, maybe I want that, maybe not, get over to rareplantstore.com anyway and look at what's available. Because he's got all kinds of cool stuff. Like I said, it's not a huge variety, but it's a great selection of things that will work for you with good advice as well and great service. You're going to get great service from Nick because he's Nick, and that's just what he does. And because I'm promoting him, he also knows that I will kill him if he doesn't give you good service. It's a joke, but it's also true. That's why it's funny. Anyway, no, he doesn't need that, though. He really is like one of the best people. I'm not even just talking about from a business standpoint. Nick Ferguson is one of the best people that I know in real life, and I'm happy to endorse him. I'm sorry if that joke maybe came off a little bit wrong. But it is true. That's true of anything. Like, when I go out and I promote people that on the air here, I am vouching for them. And that's why I'm very clear when I'm like, well, I found this, and it might be good, and I don't know, versus, hey, look, I know you can do business with these people. That's my sponsors. That's people I do one-offs for. It's always a personal endorsement, and therefore I take it seriously. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and drop on in to the Ron Paul Liberty Report highlight for the weeks and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on a peace president that's managed to bomb seven countries in, oh, just a bit over a year.
I want to start off today. We have a couple items we want to talk about. And one has to do with the ability of our country to willy-nilly bomb anybody we want to bomb. And some people now are sort of agreeing with us that little bit here and a little bit there could add up to a big war someday. But even now, when you're a totally bankrupt country with a currency going down, and then we just keep adding and a 50% increase on a $1 trillion budget for the military, and we're bankrupt, I would say we don't have to wait real long to get a little bit nervous about it. But still, it doesn't seem like Congress cares about the only people who have a voice up there are the neocons, and they have the president's ear. So that's a big problem that we have. But the the headline that we have here on this article is "Peace President," in quotes. Trump has bombed 10 countries, now plans $1.5 trillion military budget. Who are these people that he has decided to bomb? I have to look at the list. The list is getting longer.
Yeah. It's not to nitpick the president, but, you know, words have meaning. Words are important, you know, and when you say you're the peace president and it turns out you're bombing, well, you can't say that war is peace. War is not peace. That's important. That's why we're talking about it. As we speak right now, actually, just before the show started, this is why it's important. This is Benjamin Netanyahu, who is in the White House right now. He is just signed on to be on President Trump's Board of Peace. He's there with Marco Rubio. So literally, war is peace. This is a man who slaughtered probably at least 200,000 people in Gaza. He's a wanted war criminal. He's going to go back again. He's completely obliterated Gaza, but somehow now he's on the Board of Peace. And so that's sort of the backdrop of what we're saying, that war is not peace, you know. And if you go back to our that original piece that both you and I read this morning, Dr. Paul, Peace President Trump has bombed 10 countries and now plans a $1.5 trillion military budget. And so if you go back, you read the countries. He only did 7 so far this past year, but he did 3 more in his first round. And if you go to that next clip, he did 3 more in his first term. So that's a total of 10, even more than Obama. And Obama was a big bomber. Moreover, Trump is threatening to attack at least 4 more nations, Colombia, Cuba, Mexico, and Greenland. He's vowed to colonize Greenland and forcibly turn it into U.S. territory. Now, he wrote this a couple weeks ago, so that's not on the headlines right now, but he could go back to it at any time.
You know, I can't defend a lot of the things Trump does. I also can defend a lot of things Trump does. It's a mixed bag. I'm back to, as bad as it is, when special libertarians say something like, well, at least it's not Kamala, and they mean it in jest. It's the best response that I actually have, and I think it's actually a valid one, because at least we don't have cackles and tampon running the country, and I think the country's better off for it. But if you tuned in for my discussion with Pete yesterday, then you know that in the end, the ship, its course at a national level is set, and we're not changing it. We might change a little bit of what sights we see along the way, but we're headed for oblivion in the end. There is no real way to fix the problems that we have. The country and the world as a whole are run by some very terrible people. And I think one of the most important things that we said yesterday in our discussion, which if you haven't heard yesterday's interview with Pete Quinones, you might want to go listen to it, is I think one of the things we agreed on, we didn't agree on everything, but we agreed on a lot, and one of the things we agreed on was when you send good people into the belly of national government in this country, it destroys them. They either end up attacked and haggard like Thomas Massie or Rand Paul, Dr. Paul's son in the Senate, or they get co-opted. And a perfect example of that, and I didn't bring it up yesterday because how long the discussion went, is Marco Rubio. And I have some real insight into Rubio. And if I were to talk about Rubio as he was when first elected and prior to it, you would think I was a huge fan, and all I would be doing is telling you who the man was. And I know this because there's a member of our audience, many of you have met him who have been to workshops here, because he comes quite often, I'd say 7 out of 10 events he's at, who knew Marco very, very well, helped him get elected the first time he ran for any office at all, and was able to continue talking to him for several years once he was in the Senate. And then things just got worse and worse and worse and worse. And I pretty much gave my assessment of who Marco Rubio was back when he was named Secretary of State. And this gentleman was at my next event. And he came up to me and he said, I don't know how, but you are so spot on with your assessment that it's scary. And he told me the whole background information on it. And so Marco Rubio was actually a really good dude who really, you know, the kind of guy, your white knight that goes to D.C. to save humanity and do all the right things. And it didn't take long for the machine to destroy that piece of him and turn him into a globalist neocon. And so this is why a lot of you get mad at me that I don't vote in national elections. And it's because I don't see the point. Either mathematically or from a standpoint of the direction of the country. And when somebody can explain to me what I'm voting for and can explain to me how my vote matters, I'll reconsider that. Until the point where you can make the math and the reason, I'll stick to focusing on things in my life that I actually control. And with that in mind, how I invest my money is one of those things. And one place I put my money is Bitcoin. And we have a question that came in for Jesse Markowitz, and that was on how energy prices affect Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining and Bitcoin pricing. And this is going to give us an opportunity to talk about the difficulty adjustment. And I only listened to the first like minute or two of this when I was screening it, so I didn't listen to the whole thing. I'll do it with you now. We'll see if Jesse gets much into the difficulty adjustment. I don't know how he wouldn't.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today, I have a question from Ken. Ken asks, it seems to me there's a limiting factor in Bitcoin, energy. The cost of energy to mine sets a hard value. The cost of energy definitely impacts Bitcoin mining, but it's not as significant in the Bitcoin price as you might think. Bitcoin's price is determined by the buyers and sellers of Bitcoin. It is true that miners are sellers of Bitcoin because after they mine it, they generally need to convert Bitcoin into fiat to pay their normal business expenses, electricity, labor, capital outlays to buy new miners, etc. The total amount of Bitcoin being sold by miners, even if miners sold every Bitcoin mined every day, is not a huge percentage of the overall Bitcoin market. The interaction of other sellers of Bitcoin and the buyers of Bitcoin dominate the market when determining what the price of Bitcoin actually is. So, how much Bitcoin is actually mined right now? Blocks average about 1 every 10 minutes, 6 per hour, 24 hours a day, or 144 blocks per day. Miners get paid the transaction fees plus a mining reward. Transaction fees recently have been less than 1% of the block reward, so we'll ignore those for our rough calculations today. The mining reward is the actual new Bitcoin that gets mined. The reward started out at 50 Bitcoin per block and is cut in half every 210,000 blocks, about every 4 years. So 50, then 25, 12.5, 6.25, and currently 3 1/8 Bitcoins per block is the current reward. This halving of the reward is how Bitcoin limits the total ever available to 21 million. So 144 blocks per day times 3 1/8 is 450 Bitcoin mined per day, just over 164,000 per year. Average daily trading volumes in Bitcoin have been very roughly estimated at about 500,000 Bitcoin per day. So all miners together earning less than 500 Bitcoin per day as expected is very unlikely to have a significant impact on the price. So what does drive the price? Supply and demand. People and companies want to purchase Bitcoin, and since there's very little new supply coming in order for them to purchase that, they have to buy that Bitcoin from somebody who already has it. Folks who are dollar cost averaging for their purchases are buying at whatever the market price happens to be. If the price drops, many folks buy the dip and purchase even more. People who already have Bitcoin but are looking to buy something, a house, a car, may want to sell some. Others may want to sell some to take profits or limit losses if they think the price is likely to go down. A key differentiator that makes Bitcoin different than most other commodities is the production limit we talked about earlier, Bitcoin mining. If the price of gold, silver, or oil goes up, those miners will spend more to dig it out of the ground, increasing the supply. Companies will reopen formerly unprofitable mines, dig deeper, whatever is needed to produce more. Because with the increased price, it's still profitable even if it costs more to dig it out. At the end of the day, more actual gold, silver, oil will have been produced. By producing more, the supply increases, putting some downward pressure on that overall price. By contrast, Bitcoin adjusts its difficulty every 2016 blocks, about every 2 weeks. So if the amount of mining effort were to increase dramatically, miners would start mining blocks faster than the average of 1 every 10 minutes now. But within 2 weeks, the difficulty adjustment would kick in, and the average would move back towards 1 every 10 minutes. To give you some sense on this, mining capacity is measured in exahashes per second. 10 years ago, the total mining community effort across all miners, from small solo miners to big mining data centers, was estimated at less than a single exahash per second. Currently, it's estimated at over 1,000 exahashes per second, over 1,000 times increase. And at the end of the day, the average remains just about one block every 10 minutes, limiting the overall supply. So if energy costs vary, the profitability of being a Bitcoin miner might go up or down, and the amount of overall mining capacity might increase or decrease. But over the long run, with the difficulty adjustment adjusting the amount of blocks found, the long-term production on how much Bitcoin gets produced will remain the same. About 450 Bitcoin per day now, and half that starting in early 2028 after the next halving. At current prices, 450 Bitcoins per day is over $42 million. That's a large sum of money that rewards miners for doing the work required to put transactions in blocks, validate the blocks, publish the blocks, and maintain the record. Because of that large sum of money involved in this, folks are willing to spend significant sums of money on generating those blocks. The fact that it takes real energy, real cost to mine these blocks contributes to the security of the Bitcoin blockchain. The more it costs to generate a block, the harder it is for someone to manipulate the chain. Security is enforced by physics, not promises. For those who are worried about the amount of energy it requires to support Bitcoin, don't panic. While it does take a lot of energy, miners are very highly incentivized to find the most efficient sources, the cheapest energy they possibly can. Very often, there are additional societal and environmental benefits as a function of the way that Bitcoin uses energy. This includes the environmental benefits of taking flared natural gas from oil wells and converting it into electricity for Bitcoin mining instead of venting or flaring that gas. Bitcoin miners look to use otherwise stranded or wasted energy. And providing a base electric demand in an area can often allow electrification in areas where otherwise it would not be economical. So energy does matter in Bitcoin, but not in the way people often think. Energy secures the system. Markets determine the price. This has been Jesse Markowitz with yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Please do send more questions for me to Jack. I'm always looking to answer more questions on Bitcoin, running your own servers, and any other technology questions I can assist with.
Well, he did a great job on that and did bring the difficulty adjustment into it, so I don't have to say much more. There's actually something I want to address that's kind of the same question coming in a different angle, and I'm seeing it from the typical FUD-spewing retards on social media mostly. So a couple of weeks ago when the Epstein shit dropped, there was some mention of Bitcoin in it that didn't really matter. And then that got twisted to the point where Epstein bought Bitcoin and made Bitcoin and controls Bitcoin and he invented Bitcoin and a bunch of bullshit FUD. And then that kind of that blew through really quick, thankfully, because it was all bullshit. But what's also come up since then, as the price has come down, is this idea that since Bitcoin mining requires energy and it takes money, and that means that the more expensive the energy is and the less expensive the Bitcoin is, the harder it is to stay in business as a miner. So the miners will stop mining and Bitcoin will die again. And I really recommend you go to Google or your search engine of choice and type in Bitcoin obituaries and go read all the times that Bitcoin died in the past 15 years. It's a lot, and it's somehow still here. And the people that do this FUD, they never understand anything about Bitcoin. They're shit coiners, by the way. Like, they want to tell you how Roger Ver is a hero, and he's the real Satoshi, or Craig Wright, or some retard like that. And they don't know anything about how anything works, including the difficulty adjustment. So it does seem to make sense, right? Like, if it gets really, really expensive to mine relative to the Bitcoin that you earn, you'll stop mining. Well, there's a couple things involved there. And the first one, before you even get to the difficulty adjustment, miners aren't what you think they are in general. They're not all just giant companies that own all their own equipment and do all their own mining. Most of the big mining companies are actually selling hosting, for lack of a better term, like dedicated web server hosting, except they're dedicated hosting your miner for you, your ASIC miner. And what I mean by that is, for instance, there's a box somewhere in the world that the Survival Podcast and all my other websites lives on. It doesn't live in my house. I don't run multiple businesses' web server in my home attached to a cable internet connection. That would be retarded, and it wouldn't be taking the business seriously. I have dedicated hosting. Well, most people like me that do Bitcoin mining for themselves also don't have all those ASICs sitting in their home making loud fan noises and drawing power directly off the grid into their retail electrical. Okay, what they do is they hire a company that we'll call a mining company. And yes, many of these mining companies also own a lot of mining rigs, and they also directly profit from Bitcoin mining, but most of them are also selling space. And so I will pay, for instance, to have, let's say, five miners co-located at this mining facility, and they're making the same money from me no matter what. Because if their electrical rates go up, they're going to raise my price. That's how it works. So think of them like your stockbroker. Your stockbroker makes money when you make money or lose money, right? Especially if we go back to the old broker model, right, where the broker just made you broker, right, where you actually had to call a broker. You couldn't get an E-Trade or you know, something like that and get online and do your own trading not that long ago, guys. When you go back to the 1990s, when you wanted to buy 1,000 shares of Ford Motor Company, you called your broker and said, I want to buy 1,000 shares of Ford Motor Company. And he handled the order and the bookend. Okay? So think of it that way, in that the mining companies often make money even without the miners. Okay? Now, here's the, what does that mean? Well, a lot of those miners are smaller people. They don't care that maybe this month they broke even and maybe the next month they lost, you know, $100. They care about their stack growing, and they believe in it long term. So they're more stable than a purely commercial miner. They're more ideological. Okay, but there's also a lot of companies that literally their only purpose is to run equipment, mine Bitcoin, they sell Bitcoin to pay their expenses and keep the difference. And they keep the difference in various ways, but I mean their expenses include things like they have to pay themselves a salary and pay their staff a salary and all that, right? So that gets converted to cash, right? And that's what Jesse was talking about. And so, yes, there are companies that'll go, we can't mine Bitcoin with for this price of electricity and this price of Bitcoin based on math. We can't do it. So they will pull back. That difficulty adjustment, as Jesse said, within 2 weeks, a lot of times faster, because if that happens middle of the cycle, it might take 5-6 days before that adjustment will make it easier to mine. So you're worried about making it harder, you don't realize that goes both directions. So what I'm saying is, let's say 20% of the mining capacity comes offline. 80% stays online because they're buying electricity for a price. That's why they can afford to sell you space and power at a discount versus what you would pay to do it yourself, including having it up all the time and maintained in the right climate control and everything else, right? Because they're paying a wholesale rate for power. They're sitting in like Seattle, Washington, right next to the power generation at the dam, where it's hydroelectric power and it's already cheap, and they're paying a fraction. They're buying all the surplus power. They're buying flare gas off of an oil rig. They're buying the cheapest. Sometimes they're not even paying directly for the energy at all. Some of like the flare gas rigs and stuff, they're actually putting that site out there, and they're putting security at the site because they have, you know, $5 million worth of mining equipment in that Connex. And they're like, hey, you know, we really value our equipment, Mr. Oil Producer. Can we have your flare gas that you would burn anyway? And we'll put security on site 24/7, and that'll be free to you. And they're like, yeah, fuck, go, burn all the shit you want. So there's a whole lot of really low-cost mining operations. And you could cut the amount of mining back, the hash rate they call it back, to half of what it is, and it wouldn't fart a hiccup. It wouldn't matter. Bitcoin wouldn't care. It doesn't matter. And if you look at the hash rate, you can go look up the just put in Google, hash rate of Bitcoin. Find a real-time graph that shows it in real time. It's not hard to find. And you can look and say, if you go back 5 years, the hash rate was not even half of what it is today, and it worked fine then. Go back to 2015 and look at it, and it worked fine then. All of these objections The weird thing is they were already thought of in the design. This was the most perfectly designed thing out of the gate humans have ever done. I know some of you still don't believe it, and all you are is poor for it. That's up to you. You guys do what you want. Next, let's talk about foraging in more urban, suburban environments, but a unique way of looking at that with a little follow-up here. And I love this, expert councils. If you hear anybody on the council say anything, and you're like, I want to say more about that. Just don't even ask. Just do it. If you want to contact them or whatever, that's fine. But overall, just make a segment, send it in, and I'll play it like this one you're about to hear right now from Ryan Steva.
Hey, TSB community, Ryan Steva here from the homesteadconsultant.com. I wanted to kind of riff on and talk about a concept that Kerry Brown brought up on episode 3790, where he talked about urban food foraging. And he did an awesome job covering all kinds of different aspects of how to think about it, how to not be turned off by the fact that it's in an urban environment, but that there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of missed opportunity. And it got me thinking about something that I've been working on. I don't know how much I want to admit here, so I'll just say maybe, or I've been thinking about working on a project to take these walking paths, and I don't know what other people have for walking paths or what it looks like in other parts of the country, but here in Tennessee, we have all these walking paths, especially in the smaller towns and suburbs, where they've taken a big bulldozed park space, put in a blacktop trail, and called it a walking trail, and nobody ever uses it because it's either cold, wet, windy, and rainy, or it's blazing hot and wildly uncomfortable. So there's a few days a year where it'd actually be comfortable walking on these trails, but they're boring, they're bland, and no one uses them. So they're basically an open canvas for somebody like myself who absolutely loves putting in basically edible landscaping. And you might think, well, one, that's going to be really expensive to buy all those trees. I've got an answer for that. And two, how are you going to get permission from your local government to do that? An answer for that. So let's start with the permission thing. Stop asking permission. Here's the thing. Don't do anything stupid that's going to get you in trouble, but I'm guessing nobody's going to charge you for planting a tree. If you're planting a tree along these trails, if you do it right, I would personally, when I do it, you know, if I were to do such a thing, I would put a plaque next to the tree that says, this tree was donated by, and fill in the blank. It can be a fake name. It can be the name of somebody prominent in your local area. Whatever, it doesn't really matter. The plaque basically just says to whoever is mowing and maintaining that yard, somebody put this on here on purpose, and it's supposed to be here. And so they'll basically mow around it, maintain it, and keep it nice. So that's your little hack for actually getting the tree there, getting it, getting past the red tape of the government. Now, how do you get the trees for free? Well, there's multiple ways. The first and most simple really is just to plant things that can be started by seed. So there's various trees that start really well by seed, things like pawpaw, persimmons, Antonovka apples, and then we've got nut trees. So most nut trees will produce relatively true to type. So you could plant oak trees or hickories or other similar trees that are nut trees. Most of them, like I said, will produce relatively true to type. So you could just take a nut from somewhere else, plant it in a pot, get it going, get it initially established, and then transplant it on site. So the thing with transplanting and the biggest issue that I actually have found here is watering. In my area, there's enough rain that if I plant at the very, very beginning of winter, very early winter, late fall, once these trees have gone dormant, they actually establish quite well throughout the winter. And then in the spring, we have enough water for them to establish a little bit more. And if I add things like mulch or some type of mycorrhizae fungi or other inoculants into the soil, it gives these trees a much better chance of making it. So now I've basically given this tree that cost me nothing a really good head start, planted it at the right time, given it the things it needs to succeed. Maybe if I have kind of a a dry patch in summer, I'll go and take a 5-gallon bucket and water it. But otherwise, I'm just letting this tree grow. How you can think about using these is you're going to be the person who knows where all this stuff is. You're going to be the person who knows what it is, and probably one of the few people who even cares about seeking it out and using it. For example, there is a walking trail near me where it used to be a railroad, and there's some old apple and pear trees that were probably part of an old homestead at some point that have been left neglected, abandoned. I've pruned them up a bit, tried to get them a little bit more productive, and the pear trees actually produce like crazy. Well, nobody seems to care or notice that they're there. So I go each year with my girls and we pick gobs of pears. And so we can make all kinds of things like pear butter and other pear preserves, pear cobbler, pear pie, whatever it is we want. We have more than enough pears to make for it. The excess and the skins and all that go to our chickens. If we have pigs, it could go to the pigs. And then I can also bring, you know, damaged fruit, and that can all go to the chickens as well. So I can reduce my feed bill. And if I've got a whole park that maybe I planted out 5-10 years ago, full of this food throughout the season, and I plant different things that ripen and get ready at different seasons, and I can go and harvest, and now I'm doing the park another favor by cleaning up the, you know, I'm quoting here, cleaning up the mess. I've done a huge service to my entire community, but I've also, think of it this way, that I have now expanded the acreage that I have to homestead on because I'm using somebody else's acreage that was going completely wasted. So instead of, let's say somebody's got a quarter acre and you couldn't possibly plant a shagbark hickory on your property and then expect to have any space to garden. Well, now you could plant a shagbark hickory and still have space to garden. And now you can go and pick up, you know, it might be 20 years down the road for that. But many of these trees, like a pawpaw, could be producing in 5-6 years. And many of these other trees could produce, like an Antonovka apple. Additionally to that, you could start grafting on top of these seed-produced trees with known varieties of apples or pears or whatever else that you like. So I thought I'd throw that out there, get people thinking about how can you guerrilla plant and actually make your town better without asking permission, without going through the proper channels, without worrying about red tape. And again, do this carefully, but I don't think you're going to get sued or locked up or anything else for planting a few trees on a park that nobody cares about. So anyways, until next time, go get your hands dirty.
So it actually perked my ears up were these walking paths that he's using to do this in. And we have them here. We have a kind of a different problem. I don't know that we ever have much time that really would matter. It's too cold and wet down here. We get some cold, and people just don't go out anyway, so it doesn't matter, you know. But we get a lot of the other one, which is blazing hot. And you know what helps hot more than anything else when you're outside, you know, and you don't have access to Dr. York's marvelous creation known as the air conditioner? Yeah, we call that shade. And I'm just thinking of three places that I know that they have these, you know, blacktop walking paths. Well done, guys, by the way. Blacktop in Texas in August. Yeah, that's great. And they have these, they're like parks, right? And they have some park stuff, you know, like park pavilion or sports field or whatever. But they have these paths that kind of go around the outer circumference. Great idea. Great idea. I'm not criticizing it. Great idea. Except for the blacktop part. But what? Yeah, it lasts. I get it. Okay, fine. People walk their dogs and all. But, you know, summertime, you see people in the very early morning, very late evening, and that's it. Why don't they walk during the day? Because it's blazing hot, like 9 months a year here. And there's no freaking trees along the path. You want me to make it worse? You want me to make it worse? A big giant open field, grass in Texas, it's a park. What does that mean? That means the city, the county, whoever the clowns are behind it, they irrigated it. It would be dead. You guys have seen like video and pictures of my house, my backyard in like August. Everything's brown. It's all brown. Everything's brown because it doesn't rain. So they have to water it so everything's watered. And that means they also have to do what? Mow it. This is why I can't do what he's doing. I could stick trees all along these damn paths, and I could have trees growing like crazy. And it wouldn't just make food, it would make everything better. But the lawnmowers, zero turns at 1,000 miles an hour, are going to kill everything. But I say, you know, I wonder if there's some herbage and stuff in there. That might be a better idea. Maybe there usually is woods, like on one side of the path, that provide almost no shade, because the path is just far enough away from the wood line to not really benefit from the shade, at least not very much. Maybe you get it in a corner or something like that. But when I look at that, I just say to myself, self, these clowns that run local government, they have irrigation. They have maintenance and upkeep. They have people taking care of it anyway. All you do is not drive over the baby tree. Sit. All the money you waste, all the money you spend. And we could be, I just wonder, what is the linear footage, you know, spacing trees at, let's say, 30 feet on center? So you got 15 foot of canopy, nice overlap, including planting trees that are productive and producing food. How much food could America grow just lining the paths in parks with trees that produce something edible or usable in some way? Because there's trees that produce things that we can use that are not necessarily food for us. It could be food for animals or fibers and medicines and other and nutraceuticals. We could be producing literally hundreds of billions of dollars worth of foods, fibers, and medicines from trees just on paths that already exist in locations that either do not require irrigation or are already irrigated and already maintained. It's amazing, and that's why we need more guerrilla gardening, not less. On the Antonovka apple thing, is one more thing I want to comment on what he said. Antonovka apple is fantastic for producing from seed, true to type. It also is cold hardy down to 40 below zero. So I have some of it here. It doesn't die. It also doesn't produce anything. It will not, with the coldest we get, it doesn't lose all its leaves. And if it does, it's only like, eventually you get like a super hard freeze and everything turns brown and they fall off, but it doesn't actually turn. It'll never get the chill hours that it needs here. I would say like northern Arkansas, like that's your climate type and above for this tree to have any level of reproduction. Good news. Yes, Antonovka is very famous in Poland. It's called the People's Apple. It's directly bred, came out originally from Kazakhstan, where all that we think of as eating apples come from, stock originally out of Kazakhstan. But it is not the only apple that will produce a good apple from seed. All the apples that you ever eat will produce some apple that's good for something from seed. So don't be afraid to plant the seeds from a Fuji or something like that. But do try to find apples that are right for your climate when you do that as your parent stock, because that will make them more adaptable to climate. What are you going to get? It won't be a Fuji, but it'll be a good apple for something. And so we can plant the hell out of stuff from seed, like he said as well. With that, now let's hear about cholesterol from Andy McCann.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I have been eating carnivore for nearly 2 years, and the questions are great. So I was talking to one of your other expert counsels, Jesse, and we were going through carnivore and LDL and all that stuff, and I thought, hey, if I know when we were at the last fall workshop, we spoke about this, me, him, and Ken, and the message did not get through. So I thought, I should redo this and tell people, hey, yes, you actually need cholesterol in your body. If you got rid of all of it, you would be dead. So what are they doing, and why do they tell you, hey, your cholesterol's up, let's put you on a statin? What are they doing to you? I don't think it's malicious. I just think it's like ill-informed, and they don't really like want to take the next step, because most people are doing the dumbass thing and eating a lot of carbs and sugars, and they're never going to try to exercise and eat a zero carb diet like what I do. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background, but here's the nut of it. If you're doing carnivore, your cholesterol is going to go up. Your LDL is going to go way up. The reason is it's going to be using your fat as an energy system, and LDL is the transport system for fat as an energy system, in addition to cleaning out your system, right? So LDL is important. You need to ask them to get the advanced lipid study. That is when they put your cholesterol under a microscope and they look to see if your LDL is large and fluffy or dense and Denson something, Denson small, whatever. I don't even really know what that means. I just know that's what they look for, okay? So if they do that, they're going to give you probably a different answer. If they're going to say, hey, let's get on a statin, I would just ask them for that test first and take a look at it. My cholesterol is off the charts. I think it was over 300. My LDL is super high. When I went to talk to the PA and doing blood work, we went through this exact conversation. She's like, yeah, you're correct. This is actually beautiful. Even though on the surface, the false positive is you're going to die soon. She's like, really? It's actually awesome. Then they did the sugar test. And she's like, technically, you're pre-diabetic based on this number. But I know you don't eat sugar or carbs. So I don't even know what it's measuring. Okay. So that was honesty out of a medical professional. And let me go through this for you. All right. The basic stuff. I'm going to try to go fast because I got 4 minutes with you. Cholesterol is not poison. You actually have to have it. Cholesterol is nothing negative. If you took out all the cholesterol in your body, that would include your brain because it's mostly built on that, you'd be dead. It does things like build cell membranes. It works on your hormones. It helps produce vitamin D, and it makes bile in your stomach. Making bile, as I found out from my son, is super expensive, so he would actually take some HCL pills, so it's hydrochloric acid in your stomach, right? LDL is not bad. It's a transport truck. So it's got to do its thing. It's got to be there. The problem is, when it's small and dense, basically you're killing it. The HDL is supposed to go out there and clean it up. That's why they want high HDL. But really, if your LDL is awesome, then your HDL can be, you know, a lot lower, right? So it needs to be go out there to do the thing it needs to do, especially if you're doing zero carbs. Okay, so there was a question that came in about triglycerides on this subject. The answer is lower is better. So his was way up, so we need to figure out why that is. Actually, I'll put back in that blood test monitoring. I'll link it over to Jack so he can send it out to you guys. I believe it was this one right here, the CuroFit Quick Home Blood Total Cholesterol and Triglycerides Test Kit. Woo! Say that again. Okay, so the standard test for the lipid panel is just cheap and fast, and they can do that thing and boom, get an answer. Now, I would probably say 99% of the time it's spot on. If you got bad cholesterol and you're a fat ass, then yeah, you should probably do something about that. And insurance, most importantly, insurance covers this sort of thing. So typically the advanced lipid study is not, or panel, whatever it's called, is not actually covered. Okay, so also they know that, I mean, it depends on how far down the rabbit hole you want to go with this. Are they in collusion? I don't know. But they know LDL is up, there's a risk, let's give you a statin. They get paid more for that? Sure. They get paid a whole lot less for saying, oh, actually, let's do this other test and you're okay. Again, I don't really think it's malicious. I live in a friendly world, not a hostile world, but I think they oversimplify it and just move on. When you're a carb and sugar-based eater, then most of your energy is glucose, and that's not fat as a transport, right? So you don't need a lot of LDL. But when you go the other way, as I mentioned, LDL has to go up. So, for example, I'm doing CrossFit every day, and she's looking at my numbers going, holy crap. But what I would tell you is stop eating this stuff and exercise. Except we went and looked at the advanced panel, and she's like, yeah, you know, this is beautiful. More people should be doing what you're doing. So I guess I'll throw it out like this. So LDL isn't a villain. You have to have it. Without it, you'd be dead. It's a delivery truck. And the real question is going to be something like, what's in the truck? How damaged in it? How are the roads, right? How are the wheels, I guess, in this case? You know, whether it's smashing into other LDLs and causing traffic jams. So think of it like this. In the South, they're installing roundabouts. Us idiots down here have a hard time with stoplights, and they're asking us to do roundabouts. Now, take that over to, like, India, where my brother went over to India for some software stuff. He's like, Andy, it's crazy. Everyone just is like bumper to bumper and just honked their horn saying, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. I said, it's a just craziness, right? So what's better? What works? It's traffic. It's patterns. What do the cars look like? So your LDL is more like here in the South, not over there, right? But they're going to tell you, hey, it's over in India. Everyone's crashing into each other. Do the next study. Actually, probably nobody has ever really told you this. They just say LDL. What is it? So LDL stands for low-density lipoprotein. So what does that mean? They want to measure it and see if it's large and buoyant, low-density. So if your LDL is a high-dense, it's compact, it's not really what it's supposed to be, right? And what is HDL? It's high-density lipoprotein. So it's going around cleaning up your LDL. I guess I would leave you with this. Out of all the nutrition programs out there, for a long time, I did the one thing that everyone agreed on, which was stop eating sugar. So I got off of sugar, and then I eventually got off of basically any type of carbohydrate, because most of those are highly refined. So I was basically just eating vegetables, meats, and fats. And, I mean, that's a great way to go. Sweet, your tongue is an asshole, and it wants that sweetness. You just have to fight it and be like, hey, this body is mine. So anyway, that's Advanced Lipid. Go get that panel and be a little bit more certain about what's going on rather than just jumping right into the statins.
And I do have a link to the kit that Andy mentioned on Amazon in the show notes. Next up, let's hear from Nick Ferguson about rabbits and determining whether or not rabbits are right for you. Because, like I said, everybody can do anything, but nobody can do everything. So we have to pick and choose what we do. How do you determine if this is a place to put your effort and your resources and your money into?
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with another expert counsel answer for you guys. This time it's from Rich. Rich from Texas writes in with a question about taking the next step in his journey towards self-reliance. He asks whether someone in his position should consider raising rabbits as a logical progression toward eating closer to nature with less processing. If so, what else could he do beyond them being just raised for meat, like leveraging the manure, pelts, or ways to keep costs down by growing his own feed? He also wonders how self-sufficient rabbits can be, such as whether they can handle a few days on their own if he loads them up with food and water similar to his hens. For some context, he lives in a residential area with a small garden, some hens, and a bit of hidden space he has in mind for this. He's already working on self-reliance through gardening, eggs from his hens, sourcing half a grass-fed cow, and shopping at the farmer's market, and even harvesting and processing venison himself for the first time this season. Fantastic, man. I love to see this kind of progression, and I love the way you're thinking about this. I definitely think rabbits are a fantastic option for one of those first animals. It's one of the first animals that I always recommend my clients get their feet wet with. They're fantastically productive. Especially if you already have poultry sorted out with chickens, rabbits are one of those first animals that are always my go-to. They're quick to produce, they produce excellent meat, easy to process, they're quiet, you can easily supplement their feed with tree leaves, forbs, and grasses that all grow in your backyard, and if you want to really crank things up a notch, you can do like I do, and you start growing some fodder trees like white mulberry and willow. Those two, pretty much just standalone, by themselves, can serve as the vast majority. I'm talking 90% of what those rabbits will need to eat. I raised rabbits for years on not much other than fodder leaves. But that brings me to the leaving them for days at a time kind of thing. Every October, we as a family go for a few weeks to camp out in the mountains. And I have things set up with two feeders per rabbit, and I have gravity-fed watering nipples to take care of their water needs. So, I mean, you hook up an entire hutch. You've got 7 to 10 rabbits in there, and you've got the watering nipples, and you fill up a 55-gallon drum full of water. I mean, that's more than a week's worth of water, easy. It's like a month or so worth of water. And then you fill up those feeders, and they're good for a week. So that means someone only really has to come by once a week to check on them and refill the feeders. And it's really nice because even if someone doesn't know what they're doing with animals, it's open up a lid and dump a scoop of feed in there and you just fill it with pellets. Super easy, super simple. That's why the pellet thing is why I normally keep a little bit of commercial feed in their feeders at all times. It makes them adapted to both pellets and fresh fodder, so I get the functionality and the backup of the pellet feed that's commercially available, but I also get the incredible cost savings by feeding them fresh stuff all the time. And you know, having that on hand gives me the flexibility to switch straight over to pellet feeding so that I can go on vacation. So if that's important to you, that's what I would do. And if you start growing those fodder trees, the meat is just about free. You're going to have a little bit of an outlay for the commercial feed, but if you're just feeding a little bit of a handful every day kind of thing, then it's going to be pretty minimal. So The next kind of question you asked was, you know, how to, you know, expand out and be a little bit more cost saving. You could collect the manure. You can dry that manure and you sell it for a nice profit to gardeners. Just look on eBay. Look on eBay, look on Facebook Marketplace, see what it's going for in your area. I don't know exactly where you are, but if you have any kind of an urban center close by, there's a whole lot of yuppies who would love to buy your rabbit manure and use it in their gardens. Or just use it yourself instead of buying fertilizers for your garden. So you've got a cost savings right there. Even better yet, what I would do, I would run that manure through a black soldier fly bin during summer months, and you could harvest buckets and buckets of black soldier fly larvae to feed your chickens, and you can reduce those feed costs. So don't get stuck in the mentality of, I just have to focus on the rabbits. Look for ways that you can combine and stack functions between all of your animals. In addition, let's say you do get some fodder trees. You can also replace about 20% of the layer diet with white mulberry leaf. The leaf is normally over 20% protein. So, yeah, man, they're fantastic for self-sufficiency, and with a nice neutral meat to the rabbits, you can use it in pretty much any recipe you'd use chicken. So, great question, Rich. For everyone in the TSB audience, send in your homesteading, propagation, and permaculture questions, and check out the plant packs I have up on rareplantstore.com. I have some cool stuff in store this year, and that's where you go to get those fodder tree packs. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and rareplantstore.com. Do good things.
Great stuff from Nick, as always. And again, I want to remind you guys, rareplantstore.com. Get on by there this spring while you can. Spring, hell, this winter, before spring has sprung and it's too late. And see what he has. Again, we're talking about the fruit and nut tree package today, but he's got fodder tree packages. He's got a birds and butterfly, bees and butterflies package, and a bunch of other really cool stuff. I mean, he's really expanded his offering there without getting, you know, to the level of like some of these sites that have like 8,000 things. He focuses on the things that he knows will work for people in his community that'll do the type of things that actually make your life a little bit better. That brings us to John Pugliano now with kind of a grab bag on investing questions.
Hello, TSP. We got a couple questions here. First one comes from Marcus. Jack's already answered this one. I just want to chime in. Marcus is the person that had the 6.5% VA mortgage. He's thinking about refinancing, but he really wants to wait until rates get down into the 4%-ish range. Marcus, the only thing that I wanted to mention is that I think that unless there's a major economic black swan, bad economic event, that we're not going to see 4% rates anytime soon, anywhere in the fours. So I think you're being way too optimistic in trying to refinance in the 4% range. I think one of the clues to the fact that rates aren't going any lower are the things that are being proposed to stimulate the housing market. You've probably heard President Trump talking about having the government buy more mortgage-backed securities, or the privatization of the lending agencies Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And something to really keep your eyes on, and I think this is likely to happen, or at least in of some form or another, is going to be the portability of those super low interest rates. You know, right now, one of the reasons the housing market is in a stalemate, if you have a 3% or lower mortgage rate, you simply can't afford to move, and that's whether you want to downsize or upsize. That's put a real damper on the overall inventory of houses on the market. So watch for some kind of legislation to get passed to allow the portability of those super low interest rates, and I think if that happens, then you can be pretty well sure that interest rates aren't going any lower. The next question comes from Ted. He's interested in investments in advanced technology, and he's talking about investing either in mutual funds or ETFs, you know, with things like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, nuclear power, robotics, etc. Well, Ted, absolutely. I'm a big believer in investing in technology. I'll definitely list off some ETFs that I personally own. But before I get to that, let me give you one word of warning. I know you're a young guy and you're looking at dollar cost averaging in, and so you have a long-term investment horizon here. And so that's really going to mitigate a lot of risk. But one thing I want to caution against is just to avoid hype. The more that something is talked about, or the more that, you know, you're getting spam in your email, or you're seeing advertisements all over YouTube or social media, it's probably not an investment opportunity. At best, it's probably just a pump and dump. So avoid the fear of missing out and all the pie in the sky, you know, going to the moon stuff. Focus on opportunities that are profitable and making money today. And the reason I bring this up is because there are plenty of companies that have been around a long time, some of them 100 years, that are playing in the technology space, probably companies you've maybe never heard of or companies that you thought were old legacy dinosaurs, but their stocks are growing at extremely high above average rates, and that's because they're selling real current products that are profitable today. Just as an example, Seagate Technology, you know, the company that makes the old memory storage devices, in the last 12 months, they're up well over 300%. In that same genre, Micron, again, in the last 12 months, up well over 300%. And how about this one? Corning Glass. Yeah, an old glass company. Its roots go back like 175 years. Well, the modern version of Corning makes the high-tech glass that's used in touchscreen technology. So an extremely old company, something you may not even think of as being tech, and yet in the last 12 months, their stock is up over 150%. One more I want to point out. This is my favorite. Amphenol. Now, if you're a ham radio or a CB operator, you might remember that name, or at least if you're as old as I am. Amphenol's the company that invented the ubiquitous UHF connector, the PL259 that's on the end of a coax. And they invented that back like in the 1930s. So this company's been around for, I don't know, 80 or 90 years. Well, they no longer make those simple UHF connectors, but what they do make is extremely advanced cabling and connecting that's used in virtually all the data centers. They're a major supplier to NVIDIA, and you'll find their products in everything from automation to aerospace to medical devices. So again, the point being, this company that's near 100 years old, its stock is up over 100% in the last 12 months, and that's just not a fluke. Over the last 10 years, their stock is up well over 1,000%. So again, my point being, when you're looking at advanced technology, don't get caught up in the hype and betting on things that are way out in the future. There's plenty of opportunities in the here and now. Now, as far as specific funds, I personally like to own individual stocks, but I do own a number of ETFs that are focused on technology. That would include funds like Robo and BOTS, B-O-T-Z. Those are obviously AI and robotics type ETFs. I like HACK for broad exposure to cyber technology. Also, CIBR is a cybersecurity ETF that I own. ARTY, A-R-T-Y, is an ETF focused on AI and advanced technology. I am a big believer in nuclear and uranium, but I have major concentrations in individual stocks in those, and so I don't own any ETFs or have anything there to recommend. But even if you just want to go broad and safer, there are ETFs that are focused on the equal weight S&P 500, and that's RSPT. Or if you want to stick with the NASDAQ 100, there's an equal weight ETF that I own with the symbol QQQE. Hey, but in any case, you're a young guy. Absolutely invest in technology, invest in the future, and stay the course. Hey, last question, more of a generic one, and this is coming from a lot of people. You know, you're sitting on a great deal of cash, some of it in excess of $100,000 or more. You look at the market, you hear all the bad news about, is this a AI tech bubble? What about all the geopolitical issues? You know, markets are at or near record highs, and yet you're sitting in all this cash. What do you do? Well, the fact that people are worried and nervous about geopolitics or about AI bubbles, that actually encourages me. I get nervous when no one's worried about anything. And the other thing I'd say is that, you know, just like we were talking about with technology, if you have that long-term investment horizon, then it's always a good time to buy. And right now, with the S&P 500 being, you know, less than 1% away from its all-time high that it just put in a few days ago, well, even at that level, over 30% of stocks within the S&P 500 are trading below their 200-day moving average, which effectively means that if you're looking for something that's selling at a discount or at a low price, that these stocks, over 30% of the S&P 500, are at or below their one-year moving average price. Okay, in any case, bottom line, do your research, invest in quality, and do your best to avoid fear and greed. As always, thanks for the questions. This is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Setting Podcast.
So I just really am not sure how this concept that he brought up about portability of interest rates. I don't know how that's going to work because the bank has the same lending constraints on any new mortgage that they have on basically you're talking about refinancing but buying a new house. Letting me sell my house to someone who's going to pay 6%, but since I have a 3.95 rate, then I could buy a new house at 3.95%. Who's going to loan me the money that way? Because most of our legislation is not edict legislation, as in thou shall do the following. It's more of thou shall not do the following, or thou may do the following now that I previously could not do, right? And with that in mind, like, there is nothing right now that prevents a bank from saying, hey, Bill, I see you got a 4.3% interest rate. Tell you what, if you sell your house, we'll give you that right now back, and that way you can sell your house, and we can lend money to somebody else at 6%. They can do that right now if they want to. Nothing makes a bank set its interest rate as high as it sets it other than math. So it's market-driven. So I'm not sure how that would work. I actually would love to hear John follow up on this one because you don't know what you don't know. And I have never even thought about this before, and hence I have no idea if there's some mechanism that could be employed here to make that work. Is it the government making up the difference? Is that what he's saying? Like the government spends shitloads of money, so might it be a program for a limited period of time, I bet you this is it. Just thinking through it, the way it would work, you'd create a program, and the government would buy down the interest rate for the pre-existing mortgage. I bet that's what he's aiming at. That's how that would work. And this is what I mean. So Jack has a mortgage right now. My mortgage is 4%. Let's just say, let's make it really simple. And the new rate that I would get is 6%. You can always buy a mortgage interest rate down. You can buy down points, they call it. The government would say, we will buy down Mr. Spirico's interest rate to his pre-existing 4% rate. I don't know that that's a good use of the American taxpayers' money. But I've always said when you're talking about regulations and laws and bills and things, you should always ask, and this is a great thing for you to do, so you can understand what's really going on, what problem is being solved, or what problem are they trying to solve. Because you'll also often find that they sell you the legislation by saying, we're trying to solve this problem. It's not the problem it solves. And if you look deep enough, you can find the pattern. What is the problem it solves, and what are they really doing? But if the stated problem was actually the problem they're trying to solve, and that is people like mean people that are Gen X and boomers like Jack and other folks won't sell their house so younger people can get more inventory onto the market and they won't move, even though they can make a lot of money selling their house right now. And many of them are getting older and actually would rather have a smaller house. I mean, that's not true of me, but there are a lot of people that are like, I have this 5-bedroom house. It's worth $800,000. I don't really need this much house. It's just me and the wife. The kids left long ago. Yeah, it's nice having some extra rooms, but we don't need 4 of them. Little 3-2 in the burbs sounds good, but that's going to cost me $500,000 now, or $400,000, or $350,000. And I'm not selling this place because by the time I do, even to take all that money and go back into, I'm going to have the same house payment or a bigger one. I'm going to get half the house for twice the monthly cost. So fuck it, I guess I'll just sit here and be a millionaire on paper and sit in my house until I die. Now, if you want to make that person sell, yeah, that is a way to get, I probably wouldn't do it anyway because we're not sitting here like trying to figure out how. But if we were on that edge, and I'm like, it just mathematically doesn't work. And the government did this program. Jack, you're supposed to hate government. And I do. I also will take whatever works because that's the society we live in. I would then be like, maybe we can make this work now. Maybe it does make sense to cash out this larger property, buy a smaller property for less money, reduce our monthly expenses, and sell this to somebody that's more into that, hey, we have 2 kids and are probably going to have a 3rd family that's looking for a bigger home. So it would work. It's got to be how they're going to do it if they're going to do it. John, if you listen today, which you should, because it's your show, you're on. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Like, am I on the right track there? Is that what they're going to do, or is that what you think they're going to do? All right, or is that proposed by somebody? That'd be even more interesting. So, yeah, y'all got to just hear my brain work in real time. I have no idea here's how they're going to do it, you know, that quick. And that's pattern recognition. That's why I talk about it so much. If you know enough, you can logically extrapolate what is likely to happen in any given scenario. If someone were to try to do a thing based on what you know, you can extrapolate what you do not know, but you can surmise. Should do a show on that again. We haven't, like, broken that process down in a while. Anyway, let's do this. Let's now answer a question I got from someone in the audience. They're making biochar. And they want to know at, like, homestead, backyard scale, what is the best way to crush biochar? And I've talked about this method many times, and I'm going to give you the method that will get you the best results for your effort that I have found. And it requires no real special equipment. It requires two wooden frames, something to catch the biochar in. So I like using concrete mixing trays for a lot of things, and they're a good size, so they work well for what I'm going to say. A vehicle, a hard surface, like a driveway, and some feed bags, right? Or at least a feed bag. Now, the feed bag that you want to use for this, there's like two kinds of feed bags that you get shit in. One is kind of like the nylon, waxy, plasticky looking shit. Yeah, that's the one you want. Some other feed bags that you will often get are more of like a cardboard paper, and they do not work well for this because your char will be wet when you're doing this process. And the process is really simple. And what I do, first of all, is before I even go to crush it, I have two wooden frames. One is half inch hardware cloth, which is the size most people use, and one has quarter inch screen on it. I take the biochar and I put it through the half inch screen. Anything that doesn't go through the half inch screen fairly easily, just kind of moving it back and forth with a hoe, goes into some buckets to be crushed. Everything goes through the half inch screen. I then move the half-inch screen out of the quarter-inch screen on top, and I dump all the stuff that went through the half-inch screen on the quarter-inch screen. This is before I've done anything, because a lot of the char, when it fractures when you quench it, and I'm not going to go through how to make char and quench it today, but when you put water on it, it will fracture. And right out of the gate, you're going to have a shitload of char that will already go through a quarter-inch screen. Everything that goes into a quarter-inch screen goes into buckets. Those buckets are for... they're either going in the duck house, the compost, the garden, whatever. That's ready. Quarter inch and down, I'm good. I'm not going to crush it any further. I now have two grades of char. I have greater than a half inch, right, and smaller than a half inch. Those are my two grades. I'm going to put them in bags separately. And I'm going to drive over them back and forth multiple times. And I'm going to fill that bag about 25%. Is all I want to do, because I need it to lay flat and crush. And I'm going to drive over it, and you can drive over two at a time, one under each wheel. Don't do four. That doesn't work as well. I guess if you put them in order, you could go ba-boom, 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 like that. But don't have all four wheels up at the same time. For some reason, the way it disperses the weight, it doesn't crush very well when you do that. You're going to crush it. Now you're going to put it through the process again. All the stuff that was crushed... that had already gone through the half-inch screen. There's no reason to put it through the half-inch screen again. It's going to go straight to the quarter-inch screen. And you're going to now have a very small amount that won't go through the quarter-inch. And that's still half-inch. That's going to go to a bucket, stuff that goes through half-inch. I'm going to do the same thing with the big stuff. Crush it with the truck. However, that batch, this is way easier, way less complex than it sounds. I have to line it out for you. I'm going to take that material, put it through the half-inch. And again, anything that goes through the half inch will now be put through the quarter inch. All the quarter inch stuff goes to, you guessed it, the previous buckets with quarter inch and smaller in it for application. And now I have half inch and some that's still pretty big. To be honest with you, anything that after the first crush doesn't at least go through the half inch screen goes into a separate bucket called charcoal. And I use it for charcoal. I've done one crush on you. You don't want to break down. It's not going to be that much. It's not going to be that much. It just, and you can crush it again if you want to. But I just, that just, okay, that's bigger stuff. Everything goes through the half-inch screen, then goes through the quarter-inch screen. The quarter-inch stuff goes into the application storage, like the stuff I'm going to go ahead and use. And now I have nothing but a batch of half-inch. How motivated am I? If I'm not that motivated, I just use it. If I am motivated, maybe I crush it one more time. Maybe I pitch it aside and make it part of my next batch. Why all the complication? Why don't you just throw it in the bags and crush it and be done? I'll tell you why. Aggregation. When you have a bag and it's got big pieces, medium pieces, and small pieces in it, they all aggregate. And the little pieces fill in the gaps between the big pieces. It gets very compact without crushing. And you could drive over it and over it and over it and over it and over it. And very little will actually crush after that point. So by separating it, rating it into grades, large, medium, small, and going for small as your final product, you're going to get a much better crush. When I did this, I went from taking a big batch and taking like half a day of dicking around with it and going, there's got to be a better way. So I can knock this out in 30 minutes now. A big batch, I'm completely done in 30 minutes. Like I said, it sounds more complicated than it is. Just build your wooden frames to fit kind of perfectly on top of whatever your container is you're going to sift into. And what I mean by that is the inside of the frame where the metal is should sit, it should sit on like a kind of like a pot lid. So that the overreach of the frame is on the outside of it, so it holds it still. It's so easy when you do it this way. Now, here's the other side. This is trying to get all your charcoal to be about the size of a grain of rice or smaller, and this is optimum. And if you had specialized equipment, you might go even smaller. And if it was all the way down to damn near dust, that's even better in the soil. And we all know this because there's so much research that's been done in the past 15 years. And we have all these companies that sell biochar, and they want to sell a premium product so they can get a premium price. So they put out all this information about what you need. It isn't what you need. It's optimum because it gives you a large surface area relative to how big the particle size is. But the greatest soils ever built using biochar are the Terra Preta soils in the Amazon basin, and I'm promising you that these people did almost no crushing. To do it at the scale that it was done there, it was not done with kilns like was done in Asia, in ancient Asia, like made the first, you know, kettle style kilns and stuff like that. No, it was done with you pile up stuff. You let it dry, you light it from the top, and you let it burn down, and when it gets down to the bottom, you throw water on it instead of letting it burn to ash. And then you incorporate it in the soil. That's all they did. Because here's what I've noticed. I will at times be like, fuck it, I don't have a lot of time to screw with this, and I'm going to be adding material to the coop, and I need biochar. I make a batch. I put it in the bag. I drive over it once. I don't screen it. I dump it in the buckets, and I dump it in the coop. And sometimes when we pull everything out to make compost at the end of a season, you see some fairly large chunks of charcoal in it. However, you don't see anywhere near as many as are in there. A lot of it just from the ducts moving around, it all breaks down. And then when you make compost out of it, I will often screen my compost for potting soil. And I know there's a ton of biochar that went in there, and plenty of it won't go through a quarter inch screen. Because again, when I get down to that half inch stuff and it goes through a half inch screen and not a quarter inch screen, I just throw it in there. So just the composting process, some of it will then break down smaller. And I'll tell you what I've never found. And I've been doing this now for about 5 years. And I know black on black is hard to see, but I dig a lot of holes in my garden. I have never, after a season, like it's been a season since I added stuff to the garden, have found a lump of charcoal in the garden. It does in time from being wet, etc., and being in the garden, being worked by soil microbes and humic acid and everything else. It does break down in component size. The carbon will always be there, which is what you want. So the reason I went that long with it is, one, I want to tell you how to do it in an optimum way, but I want to tell you I wouldn't get so stuck on optimum that you don't use it. Because just crush it and throw it in will work. All we're trying to do when we get smaller particle size is make it work better. That's it. With that, we have wrapped up another episode. Send me more questions. I need them. I'm thin right now on content for next week. I've got a question in the bank from Andy McCann. I've got like three content pieces from him. I've got one from Ryan Steva. I've got one from Joel Riles. And one other person I can't find now. But I know there's one more person I have one from. So I almost have barely enough to do one next week. But not quite. And I always need some in the bank. And so I know I also have a couple into Antonio Gatto, and I'm sure he'll get those back. He's really good about turning them around. But we need more for him because he's new. But I need questions. Jeff Lawton, Nick Ferguson, two of the most switched on regen ag permaculture people you will ever have access to anywhere, and we have them on our expert council. Joel Riles, I mean, any questions you have on dogs and dog training, and I bet you more than half the audience to this podcast owns dogs. And I bet you a lot of people that don't own dogs that are in this audience right now, the only reason you don't own dogs is because of where you live and your current living conditions, and you want to someday. Patrick Rohrman, you know, this is one of the best knife makers in the world, also knows a lot about tool making, anything with metalwork, and a ton of other stuff. You know, I haven't had a question for Patrick in a while. Nicole Sauce. Basically, if you could ask it to me, you could probably ask it to Nicole, and we'll just have different ways of answering the same question. But, I mean, Nicole knows all types of things about the homesteading, the cooking, the food prep, and preservation. Awesome, awesome gal. Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, your medical questions, send them in. Ben Falk, we haven't had a question for Ben forever. More of a northern climate permaculture stuff. John Pugliano, who you heard from today. These are all people that are here. Waiting to serve you. Chef Ken Daniels, you have questions on cooking, get them to me. Matt Sersley on taxes, tax planning, legal issues inside the tax system. Michael Melito, that's your gun questions. And I love having Mike, and I'll tell you why. Like, I've had a lot of people apply for that position, the gun guy position. And I usually get people who are all tactical all the time. They know nothing but tactical, tactical. I was on the SWAT team. I was in the Marine Corps. I was in the Army, you know, Special Forces, etc. That is Mike. But he can still talk to you about a 30-30 lever action. And that's what I want. I want one guy on guns. That's enough for the council. I want one guy on guns. But I want a guy that can cover the whole thing. And Mike is that guy to a large degree. So, guys, I need questions. Send them in. Send them to Jack at thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC expert in the subject line. Say, Jack, my question is for expert council member fill in the blank. Put their name there, not fill in the blank, right? We don't have a fill on the council. So put their name in there. My question is, ask your question in a single sentence. Return, return. Then give me details. Separate your question from your details. Ask your question before you give your details. Trust me, I am a professional. I've been doing this a long time, and I can tell you that when a question comes in that way, it's not just me. I have watched these questions be answered by various people for 18 years. When a question comes in that way, not only does the expert council member then answer the question well, it turns out they answered the question that the person really had. When you blend it all together and we try to work it out, sometimes we answer and you're like, that's not what I meant, but it's what you said. Follow the system. It will work out well for you. With that, if you have not yet picked up a copy of my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirko, please do so. If you have read the book and you have something to say about it and you haven't done that yet, please go to Amazon and leave me a review. That really helps to keep the book in front of people. The more reviewed it is, the more it gets shown in search results. Additionally, the more likely somebody is to buy it. When somebody sees a book and it's been reviewed by a couple hundred people and has, you know, 4.8, 4.9 stars, they're at least, well, this is probably pretty good. So that's one thing you guys can do for me if you would. And again, if you already have a copy of the book and you want to keep it and you know somebody could benefit from it, it's pretty inexpensive to pick up as a gift and send it to somebody or give it to them next time you see it. And for that, I really recommend the hard copy book. because when you hand somebody something, even if they don't read it right away, it tends to stick around, and someday they pick it up, open it, and you just might help someone out with the book. I really put a lot of effort into it. Laws of Life 2, by the way, is finished. It's time for it to go to the editor. I'm just waiting on one person to get the foreword back to me, man. Come on, get it. I don't want to say who it is and jinx it yet, because I've pre-announced names on things before, and then they get jinxed. But we have a pretty cool person writing the foreword for me. I'm going to pop a little DM over to him. At least you know it's a him, right? And see if we can get that gone. But Laws of Life 2 should be out sometime this year. With that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. Also want to remind you, though, I think Nicole Sauce, let me check before I even say this, and it does look like she still has some tickets available to the LFTN Spring Workshop, April 23 through 25, that event. It's a multi-day event. It's really, really cool. You'll get to meet some really great people, including me. I'll be there. Alan Booker, Sandor Katz, Nicole Sauce, Kerry Brown, and John Pugliano, who you heard from today. Bunch of other really cool people, both instructors and just straight-up attendees. It's a really great opportunity to spend a few days with people that really are just like you. And you learn so much and build such great relationships when you get involved with something like this. I don't know how many tickets she has left, but she had 3 the last time I asked her. It still says you can order them, so it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 or less. But you can find those at livingfreeintennessee.com. Please come on out, hang out with us. Again, check out Rare Plant Store from Nick Ferguson and check out the stuff he has available. Nick's trying to get his family onto a new piece of land. He has a great opportunity trying to raise a bit of cash to get that done. So not only would you be getting a great deal on some great product, you're helping out a really good guy who's been really great to this community for a very long time. I first met Nick in 2013. We've been working together then for 13 years, and he is one of my true friends, and that's why I'm willing to push him and Nicole so hard, because we fought a lot of battles together, good and bad, all of us, and they're definitely people worth doing business with. And again, I look forward to seeing some of y'all in Tennessee in just a few months. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a bed.